Salah, and we had had some interesting speakers last September, and I enjoy October's presentations. It's certainly fun for me to connect up with people I've worked with in the past, and our guest lecturer today is Nicole Rowan, and Nicole and I have known each other for quite some time. Nicole is an environmental engineer. She is the Clean Water Program Manager for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, their Water Quality Control Division. That's always such a mouthful. And I've asked her today, we talked last week a bit about the Clean Water Act and about waters of the United States. And I spent some time on that because Nicole's going to spend a little more time on that because of some things that have happened in Colorado over the last year. But Nicole's going to give you a background of what she does and what acts, what statutes and laws apply. And if you think about it, Nicole, you might talk a little bit about the politics to some of the stuff that you do. And I know it's mostly small p politics, but it's there nonetheless. So Nicole, with that, I'm going to turn it over to you. And thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be with you all. And I'm going to go ahead and get my slides open here.
While Nicole's doing that, let me remind everyone that as she's speaking, if you have questions, just go to the chat box and put those questions in. Everybody can see them and I can see them. And then if they're pertinent to what she's talking about at the time, I'll interrupt Nicole and we'll ask the question or back up a couple slides if need to. Otherwise, we'll save questions for the end. And Nicole, you may pause every now and then and ask see if people have questions. So,
okay, back to you. Great. Is my screen in full share mode? Okay, you can see it good. Okay, great. So again, Jennifer introduced the topic today. I want to give you a little bit of overview of the Water Quality Control Division and kind of what we do and what our mission is, and then just provide you just a really brief overview of the Clean Water Act and the Water Quality Control Act, which is a Colorado statute. Spend a little bit of time on the things that we actually regulate at the division. And then, as Jennifer said, kind of take a deeper dive into a case study on Colorado and the waters of the United States definition and ongoing political, legal, regulatory battles that are happening around that regulation here in Colorado and across the country. And I am going to try and weave in a little bit of kind of the political drivers. Jennifer asked me to do that, and I was thinking about it a little bit, and I was like, oh, it's not that political. But then I was reminded of the fable of the frog in the hot water. And, you know, I think it's, you know, we're kind of always just in this nice, warm water, but every once in a while it gets a little hot, and it's not, national nasty politics, but there are some political things that happen, and just kind of share a few anecdotes with that as we talk today. So the Water Quality Control Division is in the Department of the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment. So this is the director of the health department is a POLIS cabinet member. So it's one of the major state agencies. And we have two sides to the department. The health side, who are mainly working right now on the pandemic response, have been completely overwhelmed with that and have done just so much work over the past year work to keep us all safe and provide information. It's been amazing to see that side of the department a little bit more closely than I have in the past. And then we have our environmental divisions, and so our environmental program, which houses our air pollution control division, Division of Environmental Health and Safety, the Hazardous Materials and Waste Management Division, and the Water Quality Control Division. So our mission is to protect and restore water quality for public health and the environment in Colorado. And again, we're a regulatory agency. So we have two programs, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Program, and the Clean Water Program, which I oversee. So the Safe Drinking Water Program serves as the primacy agency for implementing the Safe Drinking Water Act in Colorado. And then our Clean Water Program implements a large portion of the Federal Clean Water Act in Colorado and Colorado's Water Quality Control Act. So we have about 180 people on our team between the two programs. And so, you know, we interact with various different layers of our political system. So we have to examine both federal and state laws when we are implementing our programs. So again, the Federal Clean Water Act and the Colorado Water Quality Control Act. And then we are governed by a large set of regulations, which have the force of law in Colorado. And those regulations are established by our Water Quality Control Commission. And I'll talk a little bit more about them in a second here. And then we also develop a lot of policies, which mostly when I say policy, what that means to me in my work is really interpreting our regulation or providing some more detailed guidance about how to implement a regulation. And so just a little bit more about the Water Quality Control Commission. The Water Quality Control Division, our team members serve as staff to the Water Quality Control Commission. So when they establish regulations, it's a formal rulemaking process, and there's parties to those rulemakings. And oftentimes we are, the division is the proponent of those rulemakings, and there's a set process for how that happens.
Nicole, the commission, is that appointed by the governor?
Yes, so there's 9 members who are appointed by the governor, and they're confirmed by the Senate, and they have 3-year terms. And they have to, the commission has to have geographic diversity and reflect different water interests in the state. So oftentimes we'll have someone that's very familiar with being a regulated entity or agriculture or drinking water that has, or sometimes we've had a couple professors from major universities that have been on our commission. And there has to be at least 2 members from the Western Slope. So I think I'll pause there and see if there's any questions on kind of just the basics of what we do before I dive into an overview of the Clean Water Act and how we implement that.
I'm not seeing any. Go ahead.
Okay. So the Federal Clean Water Act was established in 1972. There was a lot of history before that, but that's kind of the major, when people talk about the Clean Water Act, that's the piece of legislation that really operates how we regulate our waters today. Colorado had a previous act prior to the Water Quality, Clean Water Act. But in 1973, they did a huge overhaul of that and replaced our previous act with the Colorado Water Quality Control Act. So kind of the major differences between the federal and the state statute, the federal statute really focuses only on surface water. And our state act, the Colorado Act, focuses on surface water, but also groundwater. Another thing that it provides the basis for ongoing regulation is for reclaimed water use in Colorado for non-potable reuse. And it also allows the commission to adopt control regulations. And I'm going to have a specific example on that in a little bit. And so the regulations and the policies that stem from all these statutes, you know, really are, again, kind of around, you know, based on legislation that's around 50 years old now. One of the things that I think is kind of interesting about the early portion and years of the Clean Water Act is that a lot of our nation's infrastructure on the domestic wastewater treatment side was established in the 1970s and the 1980s based on large grants that were provided by the federal government. So a lot of that infrastructure that treats our domestic sewage and wastewater today was regulated in that time in a new way, but there also was a lot of money available to communities across the country to build the infrastructure to meet those requirements. In 1987, those grants were phased out, and now each state has a revolving loan program, so low interest loans for communities to establish pollution controls. So that's kind of, I worked in the consulting industry for a long time, and there's lots of funny stories from the 70s and 80s about all the grants and the work that was done across the country kind of in the heyday. You know, we are facing aging infrastructure as an issue across our country. You know, not just our roads, but the pipes and the treatment plants that treat our water are also aging as we face new regulatory challenges in the future. So the main goal of the Clean Water Act was to prevent, reduce, and eliminate pollution in the nation's waters in order to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. There's also oftentimes called the fishable, swimmable goals of the Clean Water Act as well. And so those are really focused on protecting and restoring aquatic life, fish, and wildlife that use our nation's waters, and also recreational activities, so swimming and boating. So I want to spend a little time talking about how these goals are actually operationalized. So in Colorado, we have four classified uses of our state waters. We have drinking water supplies, agriculture, aquatic life, and recreation. So a waterway could be classified for just one of these uses or all four. Most of our state waters have an aquatic life goal, because anywhere there is wet water, there usually is some form of aquatic life that lives in it. And so to protect these different uses, our Water Quality Control Commission adopts water quality standards. And really what those are numeric goals for water chemistry for a given pollutant to protect these uses. So for drinking water supplies, we have a water quality standard for nitrate to protect those critical drinking water supplies. For agriculture, we have a policy to protect our irrigation water from salts that can harm crops when using water for irrigation. Aquatic life, there is a whole lot of standards to protect the aquatic life, the fish, the macroinvertebrates that live in our waters. So I think some that are probably of most issue in Colorado are metals due to our legacy mining in the high country. Nutrients, so nitrogen and phosphorus, and the algae that can form if there's too much of nitrogen and phosphorus in our waters. And selenium, and that's kind of an interesting one here in Colorado that's just based on our geology. So we have our waters are naturally high in selenium. And for recreation, the major water quality standard is the level of bacteria that can be in our waters. So how these standards normally come to be in place is EPA will typically recommend national criteria, and then sometimes there's site-specific things to our waters where we can tweak those based on different water chemistry or different species that live in our waters here in Colorado. And We then take those that information from EPA and turn that into a recommendation to our commission, and they adopt those as water quality standards. So sometimes those rulemakings can be contentious and political. And I think the major driver behind that is that the aquatic life standards that we have adopted historically and continue to adopt as science is refined are much more stringent. The water chemistry, the actual concentration of those chemicals needed to protect our species is much lower than it is for human health or agriculture. And oftentimes those standards, people are very concerned about how they're going to be implemented. And I'm going to get to that in a minute. But the main way we implement those standards is through permits to industries or to domestic wastewater facilities in the state. And so that means they have to improve their infrastructure or add on new pieces to their wastewater treatment facilities in order to meet these new water quality standard goals. And that costs money. So it could mean that there would need to be increased rates or for manufacturers, you know, or commerce and industry sources that could turn into higher prices for products. Those rulemakings can be very contentious. And oftentimes there is also contention about the actual science itself safety factors and other things that go into the setting of the standards. So another thing that the both acts, both the federal act and our act do is that you can't discharge into a state water without a permit. So I'm talking, it's kind of a term of art, but there's thing called point sources and non-point sources. So point sources are, I think, a little bit easier to understand. That's mainly like a pipe that's discharging into a stream or a reservoir from a industrial facility, such as a mine and its treatment of its mine waste before it goes into a state water, or a wastewater treatment plant at a manufacturing facility before it discharges to a state water, or a domestic wastewater treatment plant that treats our human sewage before it goes into a waterway. And then we have non-point sources of pollution. And those are mainly from agricultural areas. So those, they aren't regulated. It's a voluntary program that we have and also a providing of financial assistance. So that is really focused on voluntary control measures. So stormwater runoff from agricultural areas, also historic legacy mining areas and stormwater runoff. There is some stormwater runoff that is regulated and considered a point source. So two examples of that is stormwater from cities. It's called municipal separate storm sewer system. So it's the actual pipes that carry the storm from the storm drains that you see along the street that carry that water to rivers. And also stormwater from construction sites. So any construction site over an acre has to have a stormwater permit that's mainly focused on erosion and sediment controls. So an example of kind of a regulation that covers both non-point source and point source regulations is our nutrient management control regulation, which is Regulation 85. And Jennifer asked me to touch on this one real quick. This was a political hot potato back in 2012, and it's still ongoing. We still have a long way to go before we are fully controlling nutrients here in Colorado. But that regulation focused on point source controls for domestic wastewater treatment plants, and there's a phased approach that we're using to control pollution from those sources. And then it maintained a voluntary approach for agriculture sources, but it did give our Water Quality Control Commission an out, kind of, so that if those voluntary measures aren't working, that they could consider actually regulating agriculture in the 2022 timeframe. And that regulation is up for its normal routine review next week. And at this point, we aren't recommending that our commission take on regulatory efforts for agriculture here in Colorado for nutrients or any other source at this point. But there's still a lot of work that we need to do, I think, to document all the good work that is happening around Colorado to reduce nutrients using best management practices and other educational aspects of nutrients. So I talked a lot there. I'll pause real quickly and then I'll talk a little bit more about permitting and then move into the case study.
Nicole pauses. And if you have a question, just go ahead and hop in. I'm not seeing anything, Nicole. Go ahead.
I have a quick question.
Oh, okay.
Oh, good.
I was interested in the historic legacy mines. So what are you guys doing about those? Because obviously that's, I mean, a lot of money that it takes to kind of remediate them. Is like Colorado taking responsibility and working piece by piece to remediate them, or yeah?
So yes, and this is kind of a long storied history as well. So there are a great deal of abandoned mines in Colorado. A lot of them aren't actively draining anymore. There are several sites where we have partnered with our hazardous materials and waste management division under the CERCLA laws, the Superfund laws, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act laws to the ones that are contributing a lot of heavy metal load. Those are under active cleanups with that agency, but they do have a permit where they are allowed to discharge the treated water from those facilities. And then we've done a lot of work with our Division of Mining Reclamation and, I can never get their acronym right, Minerals, and it's our mining agency. It's our sister agency in the Department of Natural Resources. And we've partnered a lot with them to work on best management practices to control runoff in some of the places that are contributing the most from a draining adit perspective. One of the key things that is preventing probably wide-scale cleanup of some of these areas is that it is has to do with liability and under the Clean Water Act of having to perpetually treat these places forever and the expense associated with that. So a good Samaritan can't go in like an NGO, a non-governmental organization or a nonprofit, couldn't go in and partially treat those areas. They'd be on the hook for treating to the full to protect the water quality standards. And then they would have that liability of having to maintain that permit coverage. And there's been a lot of activity to try and overcome that kind of institutional hurdle. EPA is forming a new office of mining and related activities in Colorado. It was just announced in the last week or two. You know, I don't know if they will have more energy to take that on here in the West. It's definitely something that there's been, you know, national legislation that's been put forth many times that hasn't made it through. So I think until that kind of legal hurdle is overcome, there still is going to be kind of just a piecemeal approach to addressing abandoned mine pollution in Colorado and elsewhere in the West.
Thanks, Nicole. Also, Dick Tinsley had a question. Dick, do you want to hop in here? Okay. Let me read it. He put it on chat. When we look at the high country, the concern is for heavy metals from mining active and abandoned. However, when we get to the plains, the concern is for light metal from municipal waste and agriculture. What happened to the heavy metals? that they seem to have disappeared.
So the majority of our, so we do, one thing we have to do is look at what of our waterways are impaired for, that have impaired water quality based on those water quality standards. And we have to give a report to EPA every 2 years. And so, yes, the majority of our streams that have impairments for metals are in higher up places. And there is a significant amount of dilution that happens as you move downstream just from snowmelt. So I think that's probably a large part of what's happening. You know, there also are water diversions that bring that water over to the west, to the east slope, that's used for drinking water and then diluted with other things that you're right. The metals downstream of cities are a lot less. Probably the bigger contributor is, you know, urban stormwater runoff and some low levels from wastewater treatment plants that would that we don't uptake in our bodies from drinking water, and they aren't removed from wastewater plants. So,
and I think you can go ahead. Thanks.
Okay. So I'm going to talk just real briefly about what we regulate. As far as the number of permits that we maintain about 9,000 permits that we have to renew every 5 years. And that's not something, just given our resources, that we're supposed to renew them every 5 years. In reality, it's probably 7 to 8 years. And so those permits still are in effect. It's just that the permit term has expired, but the permits, they still have permit coverage. So we have about 5,000 permittees for the construction sector. I talked about those a little bit earlier. That's really the stormwater permits focused on controlling erosion. Our second highest number of permittees is the commerce and industry sector. So that's a lot of stormwater from commercial and industrial sites, but also our mining industry, our manufacturing, and also a big portion of that is actually sand and gravel operations throughout the state. Public and private utilities really, again, is the domestic wastewater treatment point sources. So even though this is a smaller number of the things that we permit, these permits are large and complicated, and our funding actually, we get quite a bit more funding to address public and private utility issues than we do any of these other five sectors that I have listed here. Municipal separate storm sewer systems, again, that's the stormwater from cities, from larger urban areas across the state, and their permits are really focused on best management practices and education practices to control pollutants in stormwater. And then we have a pesticide permit too for applicators of pesticides to waterways. So a permit really is like a driver's license. It's a license to put pollutants in water at a certain amount so they won't harm those classified uses that I talked about before. Sometimes the political issues here are what's driving low permit limits. Again, are the aquatic life to protect fish and the aquatic insects. And so oftentimes that can get pretty heated when you're talking about protecting a water flea versus, you know, a drinking water source. So there is, I think, a lot of questioning of what are our societal values when it comes to these uses and what are we trying to protect that can cause some consternation and conflict. We also, besides issuing the permits and making sure those are current, we also have a compliance program. So the permits require the facilities to submit us information on a monthly or quarterly basis. So we review that against their permit conditions. And we also do physical inspections of some of the larger infrastructure. And if a facility is chronically violating their permit or discharging without a permit, we can enforce on those systems. So I want to talk a little bit about the difference in the type of permits that exist. So Colorado, the permits I've been talking about are in Colorado called Colorado Discharge System Permits. At the national level, those are called National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permits. And so we have been delegated by EPA to issue those type of permits in Colorado. The other type of permit is a 404 permit, and that is a dredge and fill permit. So if you're going to fill a waterway or fill in a wetland, you are required to have a 404 permit. We are not delegated for 404 permit authority in Colorado. So the majority of states do what we do, which is the 402 or the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits. I think there's only three states across the country, Massachusetts, New Mexico, and New Hampshire, that aren't delegated to do their own 402 program. On the contrary, only two states are delegated to issue 404 permits. In Michigan and New Jersey, there are several other states that are seeking that authority based on kind of what's happening at the national level with the Waters of the United States that I'm going to get into in a minute. But there was historically funding that was available with the 402 program that we still get from EPA today through grants. There is no funding to issue for states to issue the 404 permits. And the 404 permits are not issued by EPA. They're issued by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And I'll stop there and then talk really quick about enforcement before I go into the case study.
Questions, anyone?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So do you know if those states that seek to take over the 404 are seeking that because they're wanting stricter standards, or do they just want control?
Probably a little bit of both would be my guess. I think I'll give an example here of the loss of protections that we are facing in Colorado because of the new rule. Colorado's interested in that loss of environmental protection and doing something about that. And I think other states are as well. I do think that there is some desire on some states to just, there's been a constant change of this definition of waters of the United States for many, many years. And it's a lot of regulatory uncertainty for the regulated community and the construction industry. And so I think there is interest to just not be part of this national problem and just do things on our own as states.
Go ahead, Nicole.
Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit about enforcement. A really big thing happened during the last legislative session, and our historic ability to fine someone if they are in violation of a permit or discharging out a permit has historically been $10,000 per day. In 2020, the legislature passed a bill. It was House Bill 20, 1143, the Environmental Justice and Projects Increase Environmental Fines Bill. And it did make it through the legislature before they shut down and reconvened in June. And so I don't know if it wouldn't have made it through before COVID hit, if it would have happened. It basically, the dollar amount that it is now matches the amount that EPA can fine for a water violation. And it allows us to increase that number annually based on inflation. And the bill focused on both our air and water penalties. And I really don't know if this bill would have made it through if it was just focused on water. Air is definitely a bigger deal right now with this governor than water issues are. And there definitely is a huge focus on our air quality issues in Colorado, and that really drove the day. So we were able to kind of eke in under their coattails on this one. And it's a really big deal for us. And so, you know, we have to work with our commission to put this number into regulation and update it annually. But it really will help us, I think, work with some, you know, there aren't many bad actors, but there are some. And this hopefully will provide a more meaningful deterrent to those violations in the future. And I will pause on all of the Clean Water Act and permitting and Water Quality Control Division stuff that I've talked about before I get into the case study.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I talked a little bit about the difference between 402 permitting and 404 permitting. 402 permitting, the point source permitting, the discharge from a pipe or a stormwater system into a state water versus a 404 permit, which is a dredger fill permit. So I think this kind of says it all. So there is one mention of the word waters of the United States in the Clean Water Act. And that's really the term navigable water means waters of the states, including the territorial seas. So this has really been then a focus of defining what a waters of the United States is or navigable water is in regulation then or policy by EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers since 1972. So at the federal level, if a state doesn't have delegation for the 402 or their own definition of state water, which I'm going to get to in a minute, that means that, you know, the waters of the United States is where those 402 permits can be issued. Similarly, for 404, since so many states don't have their own programs, it's only where those permits are only required where it is under regulation, a water of the United States. There's been a long history of defining this in different ways. So again, the Corps of Engineers issues these permits, but they do that kind of through an MOU with EPA, a memorandum of agreement or understanding. And again, there's been different ways that they have tried to define waters of the United States in regulation. It's also been the definition of waters of the United States has been subject to three recent Supreme Court cases. The 2006 case, which is fondly referred to as Rapanos, resulted in a 2008 policy that is in effect in Colorado today. And kind of the key thing that you'll hear talked about the Rapanos rule is significant nexus of an upland water to a downstream water and how those upland waters can impact the water quality of downstream systems. The 2015 Obama rule really focused on that significant nexus determination of that 2006 case. That rule was repealed. There was lots of lawsuits around the 2015 rule that are still actually happening. But that rule was actually repealed in 2019, or the beginning of this calendar year. And it's been replaced with a rule that was finalized in April. And the 2020 rule is focused on the 2006 Supreme Court case too, but there was a portion of that ruling that was focused on relative permanence of water. And so that rule is really focused on defining relative permanence versus significant nexus. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about state waters. So Colorado doesn't rely on the waters of the United States rule for where we regulate our things in Colorado. We have our own definition of state waters. And this is a really common thing. Most states have their own definition. And most states' definitions of state waters is much broader than any definition of waters of the United States historically. So some key things here means any and all surface and subsurface waters, so all surface water and groundwater, which are contained in or flow in throughout the state. And then there's some exclusions for water that's withdrawn for drinking or treatment, and or for use such as an irrigation system. So I kind of tried to depict graphically why we're so concerned about the 2020 Trump rule. So if you imagine that our state waters are this big blue pie, and the 2008 guidance provided protection for, we think, 80 to 90% of our state waters. So a pretty good chunk, not all, but a pretty good chunk of our state waters were covered through 404 permitting by that required a 404 permit under the 2008 guidance. Based on the analysis that we've been able to do, and this is not a simple exercise because these are very legal definitions that require extensive field verification that you can't really just do from a GIS map, unfortunately, is that we think 50% of our state waters will no longer have protection under the 2020 rule. So the yellow piece that's left on the screen is really what we're losing from an environmental protection perspective. So the blue area there never had permits. The yellow and the green area have had permits before. But what we're facing if the Navigable Waters Protection Rule or the Trump Rule goes into effect here in Colorado is a significant loss of environmental protection. So we have done some things about this. we've entered into some litigation. There was a multi-state effort that sued the federal government on the rule. Colorado chose to go it alone and file our own complaint in the District Court of Colorado. We filed our complaint in late May, and we also requested that the rule not go into effect here in Colorado, that the Corps not issue permits under that new rule. In the middle of July, a district court judge, Judge Martinez, granted our request to not have the rule go into effect here. Colorado is the only state in the United States where the rule is not in effect. All 49 states are operating under the new rule. So we're very thankful that it is not in effect here, and we have a little bit more time and space to talk about what we're gonna try and do if it does go into effect. It is having a significant probably impact elsewhere, which is unfortunate. The stay of that rule, so again, it's not in effect here in Colorado, that was appealed to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And all of the written materials for that appeal have been finalized in August. And there will be oral arguments November 18th, 2020, on whether or not the rule will go into effect here in Colorado or not. We don't really have a good idea of when we'll know, but it'll probably be towards the beginning of next calendar year. So during the Colorado legislative session, after COVID, so when we had started some initial discussions before the legislature shut down, but when this really became a little bit crazy was in June, when they were back in session for that 2 or 3 week period. We did float a draft bill to try and, because we didn't know at that time if the stay was going to happen or not, if the rule was going to go into effect here in Colorado or not. So we wanted to have a backup plan if the court did not stay the implementation of the rule. So I'm going back to the graphic we talked about before. What we really tried to do was focus on a bill that would amend the Water Quality Control Act to allow dredge and fill activities in Colorado, which it doesn't do now, focused on those gap waters. So again, the waters that historically had protection, but wouldn't under the Trump rule. So there was a lot of confusion about what gap water meant. We had lots of stakeholder meetings in that 3-week period to kind of talk about what this was trying to do. There was also a need for funding. Again, there is no federal money for this type of effort. So we needed to also have a way to raise money to do this as well. The bill did not get introduced. There was a saying during that brief reopening of the legislature that things had to be fast, friendly, and free. And this bill was none of those. So it did not go anywhere. But we had a lot of good conversations and are still having those conversations today. And we got the stay. So that's all good news for us. So we are having a stakeholder process. This is kind of just our meeting plan that we're following. We've had 2 meetings. We have a 3rd meeting in November. We may have another meeting between now and the end of the year. We're really focusing on defining what these gap waters mean in words that mean things to people that would get permits or not get permits, and are continuing to try and figure out how we could potentially map what a gap water is, mainly for illustrative purposes, not for anything that could be used in a regulatory way. And I think that's all I had. So hopefully we still have time for questions. I did okay. We're 45 minutes, 47 minutes. Thank you so much for your participation and interest in this topic. And I can stay on for as long as you want to answer questions.
And Nicole, we appreciate that. That was very well done. Why don't you unshare your screen?
Okay.
And then we can see... timing was perfect. We tend to go over a little bit anyway, and we try to answer all the questions that come up. So that was very good. So first I'm going to turn to the students and see if any of them, I know Johanna and Mattia had asked some questions. Natalie, Miles, Rhythm, have you got any questions for Nicole?
I have one. So this kind of goes back to when you're talking about the EPA water quality standards, and you were talking about how a point of contention is sometimes issues with the science itself. I was just kind of wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. I think a really good example of that is nutrient criteria. So those levels for nitrogen and phosphorus. So when EPA originally kind of recommended a starting point for what the levels should be that are protective of aquatic life, they used an approach based on ecoregion type across the United States and looked at available nutrient data, nitrogen and phosphorus concentration, and used a statistical approach to recommend a number. So like 25 or 15% a percentile of that data. So they didn't look at the actual effect of what those nutrients could do in water. So when there's too much of nitrogen and phosphorus, it can cause eutrophication, which can increase algae and then have impacts on pH and dissolved oxygen. So they didn't make those linkages to the actual impact on aquatic life. And we've been fighting about it ever since, what the right model is, what the right system response model is to know how much algae is going to be generated and then what impact that could potentially have. Just nutrient enrichment itself, just too much nitrogen and phosphorus without the impact to algae or dissolved oxygen or pH can impact micro, macro invertebrates. So there's a less diverse aquatic community. So it's a little bit easier to look at it from that perspective, which is what we tried to do in 2012, but EPA didn't approve that. And so now we're still talking about the science, and we have a schedule to try and resolve that as best as we can by 2027. Does that help?
Hey, I don't see any of the students having any questions. What about the rest of you? Have you got some questions? Go ahead, Taylor Winchell. Why don't you ask your question?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for your talk today. I was just wondering if you foresee any water quality regulatory changes as climate change continues to come to fruition and certain water quality standards become more difficult to meet. So like low-hanging fruit is stream temperature, but there are others that will certainly become more difficult. I'm just wondering where that is in discussion.
Yes. So we definitely are more on the adaptation side of climate change versus the controlling it. But I talked about our permits and how they're renewed every 5 years. So as science becomes more available, as the standards change, as there's a lot of times those permits take into account dilution, so how much water is in a stream. So we use most recent information. So as our streams potentially become drier from climate change, it would be calculated into that permit calculation. We do have temperature standards here in Colorado for our water, which a lot of states don't necessarily. So that really is helpful. So we can see if there are impacts and increasing temperature. One of the things that a lot of our wastewater facilities right now are having a little bit of problems with is our temperature standards change throughout the year. They're colder in the winter and a little bit warmer in the summer. So they're seasonal standards, but there's a transition zone in the spring and the summer that just naturally happens that we don't quite understand how the fish are acclimating to that jump or that step up in standards. And so some of our wastewater facilities are having difficulty meeting during that transition zone. And so we've been working with them on different ways to address that. But there may become a time when the summer temperatures, they're not meeting because it's just the water temperature. So it is definitely something we are working to help from an adaptation perspective.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, Nicole, I'm not seeing anything else, but this was... go ahead.
I was just wondering, you mentioned that Colorado was the only state that really filed a complaint or was it the only one that got approved?
It was the only place where the rule was stayed. So there was a multi-state lawsuit that is still ongoing on just the merits of the case. And there's several of those happening across the country. There's lots, I don't know if there's hundreds, but there's probably a lot. There's probably 20 to 25 lawsuits happening across the country just on the rule itself. But we were the only place that was able to get a stay of the rule. So there was like a 17 state coalition that wasn't able to get the stay in those 17 states. A lot of them are Western states.
What district court did they go to?
California.
Oh, okay.
Well, Northern California, which was a shock. We were all, it was so crazy because that June 19th, I'll never forget it. So like at 3:30, we got news that the multi-state stay didn't happen. So we were just like, oh, we're dead. And then at 5:30, we got the judge's ruling here in Colorado that the stay had been granted. And it was a Friday. And my dad was over here for dinner outside, not inside. And I was reading him excerpts from the case because the judge was quite snarky. Even though we were successful, he was very, very snarky. So my dad was like, you are the biggest nerd because I cannot believe it's a Friday and you're reading this to me.
And Nicole is right. She was by it, but there are still the lawsuits going on about the Obama rule.
Yeah.
So it's all, as I described last week, it's all really a mess.
Right.
And that's where Colorado's trying to deal with it in-house a little bit more.
Right.
Well, I'm going to stop it there and remind everyone that next week we have Ian Stanford from American Whitewater and Greg Canova, I can never pronounce his last name, from Ducks Unlimited. And they're going to talk about recreational water use, water law, water policy, and water politics. Thank you all for joining us so much and have a good evening. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you. Bye-bye.